This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hear how dividing downtown into three separate zoning districts can improve walkability and the amount of time spent in downtown. Currently, downtown is just one large zone.
A 26 square block downtown is something more akin to what you'd find in Milwaukee or St. Louis.
GLT's Mike McCurdy talks with Bloomington Community Development Director Tom Debereiner about the city's core and progress on a citywide zoning overhaul. Plus, Laura Kennedy looks at the future of nursing with the Dean of the Mennonite College of Nursing at ISU. Unit 5 will open school on time, but how long it can stay open is a question, and what to do with nuclear waste in Illinois. That and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. An effort to revise Bloomington's zoning ordinances is nearing the one-year mark. Aldermen approved a contract with consultants in August of 2016 to wipe the board clean and start over, developing rules about what kinds of structures and uses can locate where in the city of Bloomington. Since then, the consultants have developed suggestions for downtown Bloomington, which include dividing the downtown into different districts. Tom Debereiner is the Bloomington Community Development Director and says while he would have given Bloomington's zoning codes a grade of C, now that the process to review and revise codes is underway, he'd lower the grade.
And that C grade may have been optimistic. The more we've gotten into the existing zoning ordinance, the more problems we find in terms of consistency and out-of-date styles of recommendations that we need to correct. So we have gotten into that process, and we've done a very detailed, the consultant has done a very detailed analysis of the existing ordinance. And that's why I say, well, maybe it wasn't quite a C.
What are some primary issues that you're hoping to address with the revision? Besides, you're looking for consistency, you know, no ordinances that are in conflict with each other.
Correct. And well, we're trying to achieve a couple different things. First of all, we do want to modernize the ordinance so that we don't have those old references to telegraph systems and the like. But we also want to make it easier to use for everyone, for staff, the planners, but for builders as well, developers, anybody who comes in from the outside and picks up our ordinance for the first time and has to find their way through it to get a sense of what kinds of rules and requirements are going to guide their development.
So how's the process going so far?
Well, we had some hiccups up front. We had some trouble getting things rolling. And then the project manager for the consultant, Halcia Levine and Associates, left that firm. So there was a gap there. So we're moving slower than we had initially thought we would. And in fact, I think in January, we thought we might be closer to finishing up at this point. We have to push that off till the end of this year.
The community received a bit of a preview of what's going on during a recent downtown task force meeting. Is more attention being given to downtown and the downtown area in relation to other parts of the community? Does it demand more attention as the city's core?
I think generally downtowns deserve more attention. But I have to go back to the comprehensive plan. The comprehensive plan, in fact, said we want to devote more time and energy to making our downtown thrive. And if we go back to the very beginning, you know, this is Planning and Zoning 101. If you have a comprehensive plan, that serves as your foundation for writing any ordinances afterwards, the zoning ordinance being the primary ordinance that we worry about to help implement the comprehensive plan. That's where we are with that process. So virtually everything that the consultant does is take what is in the comprehensive plan and then translate it into an ordinance format before staff sees it and before the Planning Commission sees it.
And we're starting to see a few specifics. For instance, currently downtown is one zoning district, correct?
Correct.
Where is it likely headed?
Well, that's a really interesting question because we have about a 26-block downtown zoning district right now. That's huge. That's massive. And it's not to say that it should that it's all going to change, but what we do need to realize is that the core of our the essential core, the middle of that downtown is really what people think of as the downtown and the area that, that we need to focus on. A 26-square-block downtown is something more akin to what you'd find in Milwaukee or St. Louis, much bigger cities. Cities our size really should be looking at 4, 5, 6 blocks, square blocks, and focus on that as the essential portion of the downtown. So one of the things that we're trying to do, and we're working with a consultant on this, is to define that area, and we've given them some suggestions, provide a transition area, because right now our downtown backs right up to residential at the outskirts. We need a transition from that core to the area that where it meets the residential. And then there are some unique neighborhoods like the Warehouse District that we think deserve some special consideration.
So core, expanded core, and then the transition area. Those are sort of some of the, and the Warehouse District are some of the different things that
correct.
House of Levine is currently recommending.
Correct.
So the geography for the core, how many square blocks and exactly where would that area be, sort of in and around the McLean County Museum of History?
Yes, the History Museum would be right in the middle of it. And there are some things that you take into consideration when you're defining the core. You don't want great expanses of parking. Surface parking is a problem. People don't like to walk. If you're a pedestrian, you know, what's the least attractive area of your walk down a sidewalk? You know, when you're going building to building and it's every 30 feet or so, you've got a new building to look at and window shop. That's attractive. That's something that keeps you interested in the
keeps
downtown.
The walk virtually shorter.
It keeps it longer in that they visit the storefronts at that point.
But sure, but it doesn't feel as long.
It doesn't feel as long. It feels like you're making progress. It feels like you're experiencing the downtown. As soon as you hit those parking areas, those surface parking lots or even parking decks, it starts to feel unfriendly and you just want to get by it and you're kind of looking beyond where, you know, how do I get to the next stop? Those kinds of things help to guide where that downtown should be. So if you take a look at where the History Museum is and you really extend maybe a block or half a block in some cases from there, you can start to define what really is the core, what people would experience as our core. From there, and that's not to say that that's it for 30 years. We can do things like catalytic projects or other special kinds of projects that help to expand that core. But we want to make sure that that core receives direct attention.
So what sort of opportunities does dividing downtown Bloomington into multiple districts present? What sort of things can we do by doing that?
I think we'd like to be able to address residential opportunities in the downtown differently, making sure that things are walkable in the core and the areas immediately surrounding the core. And then beyond that, you want probably a bit more of a balance between some parking opportunities. We still want it walkable, but we do want to incorporate automobile opportunities in there as well.
How would you describe the walkability of downtown currently? Some people would look at that and say, you got sidewalks, it's walkable.
Sure. Well, walkable is defined differently in many different ways, and it comes back to the kinds of things that we were talking about. Do we have reasons to walk? Is it a friendly walk? Is it a clean walk? Is it a safe walk? Are there things to look at? Frequently, every 30 feet or so as you're walking down the sidewalk. Maybe you've got a destination, maybe you don't, but you know that's the feeling that you're going to get. And as soon as you get outside of that, you might experience some parking stretches and other things that are less interesting to you as a pedestrian.
What about actually accessing what you're talking about as the core, the buckle area? Sometimes people refer to it as that. As a pedestrian, if you're coming from the west, you have to cross three lanes of traffic. If you're coming from the east, you have to cross three lanes of traffic. Sometimes people aren't paying attention to the lights and they're darting across what is fairly fast-moving traffic.
Sure. And we're defining our core as inside
the buckle.
Of the buckle.
So
yes.
People have to access that,
right.
And you hope by walking in some cases.
By walking, and on the edges, we've got parking decks. We also have an interest in providing parking, some surface parking nearby, so that you can park and then, walk into the center area.
Anything to make it easier to cross into that area? Either slower traffic, better crossing?
Those are state routes, so we have to work with the Illinois Department of Transportation on that. Ideally, you want to reduce those barriers, the number of those barriers, and make it easier to cross.
You mentioned windows and design elements to try to keep things interesting for pedestrians and people who are using downtown Bloomington. Do those design elements and the number or size of windows vary from core to expanded core to transition?
Ideally, yes. And in fact, in that walkable core, you want more window space. You want it nice and bright and visible. And as you get away from the core, you can get away with a little bit less window space, as an example. So there are design elements that you need to take into consideration that work best in a core versus a fringe area.
Is this form-based code light? Are you talking about these kinds of design elements, the size of windows, what they look like, maybe facades? Is that where you're headed?
Like anything, form-based code came out strong and became really the thing that everybody wanted to do at one point. Now we're taking, the most successful elements, I think, from form-based code and incorporating it into really a standard zoning ordinance like we have, so that we're not really moving to a form-based code, but we're taking the positive things, the things that are successful out of form-based code, I think, hopefully we'll be recommending those to the Planning Commission.
Let's shift for a moment to some of the discussions being held by the Downtown Task Force and how it may or may not intersect with some of these new zoning rules being developed. As it concerns walkability, will we see a portion of a downtown street devoted only to pedestrian use, and do zoning rules come into play there?
Came up at the last meeting of the task force where they might want to consider closing off, a portion of Main Street at the 400 block and 500 block in that vicinity. And really, I thought that was one of the more bold ideas that came out of that discussion at that last meeting. It's not really a zoning ordinance thing. There are a lot of things that work into that. You've got to work with public works, closing off streets. You've got to really define where you can go with expanding the stores. A lot of people, a lot of communities who do this have outdoor seating that really takes up where the parking is now. We do need to keep an aisle open in the middle for emergency access. So there are things that need to be, there are questions that need to be answered there. But in terms of what the comprehensive plan says, I think it's very consistent with doing something bold and creating a sense of place, creating an identity. I think those kinds of things that it's very consistent with.
And what about parking regulations? There's been some discussion about flipping parking, and by that I mean free in the garages and paid for on the streets, either through enforcement or metering.
I don't know where that discussion will go. There are things that to a certain extent we could do pieces of that without a study. We're talking about doing a parking study at some point in the next couple of years. Elements of this could be done right of way. Elements of closing down a block to traffic could be done without a study. We could just move ahead with it, with some discussion, obviously.
Bloomington Community Development Director Tom DeBruyner talking with GLT's Mike McCurdy. DeBruyner says there's opportunity for public input as the Planning Commission reviews zoning changes and before the revised code goes to the City Council. The Council is expected to hold special meetings or work sessions before adopting or rejecting changes, and a vote could come at the end of the year. DeBruyner says a typical homeowner will likely not notice a change in their neighborhood. Over time, he says, residents will see a change in their ability to expand their home and find the zoning codes easier to use when needed.
Support for GLT comes from State Farm Bank, offering mortgage consultation and rates to help you move from renting to owning your home. Additional information available by calling 1-855-891-HOME. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. NMLS ID 139716. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the state funding crisis is not over. Who's still affected? Coming up. The Mennonite College of Nursing at Illinois State University hopes to change the makeup of the future nursing workforce, plus where those nurses choose to serve. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more on a pair of grants that will help the college achieve its goals.
Many of tomorrow's nurses begin their path to a medical career at Illinois State University's Mennonite College of Nursing. And thanks to two recent grants awarded to the college, those who may never have considered a career in nursing will find their way, and perhaps to an underserved area of the country. The college was awarded a $1.4 million Advanced Nursing Education Workforce Grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. This grant will help students in the family nurse practitioner sequence get training in nursing in rural and underserved settings. And a $2 million grant, also from the Health and Human Services, was given to the college to support developing diversity in the nursing workforce. Judy Newbrander is the dean of the Mennonite College of Nursing. And she says, regarding diversity in the nursing workforce, the faculty of the college saw an ongoing national trend and decided something needed to be done.
We lack diversity within nursing. And so as part of that, we wanted to find ways to increase diversity because there's very clear research that demonstrates that patients that are cared for by people who look like them, come from a culture that they come from, they do better. They get well better. So the way that we can help with that is to increase the diversity within our College of Nursing.
Why have there been those gaps? Why have we not seen as much diversity in nursing over the years?
Social determinants is a big part of what happens within education and particularly nursing education. Those things way back in our background that kind of determine our path. And so when we are able to help students that come to Mennonite College of Nursing, help them maybe have extra mentoring or tutoring or finances, which is all the things that this grant provides, we're able to help those students perhaps catch up and be able to be successful as a nurse.
Well, what are the specifics that the grant provides? I mean, it does allow for tutoring and it does help with students, but does it allow anything for faculty as well?
Yes. We've put in this grant. We're going to do diversity education for our faculty and staff. We're also going to do mentor training. So not everyone knows how to be a mentor, or particularly a mentor for someone from a diverse background. And because we even lack diversity within our faculty, which we continue to work on all the time, educating our faculty on how to mentor students from different backgrounds is very important. So we have all of that in the grant.
With this money, you will be able to recruit students from various ethnic backgrounds. How do you go about recruiting them?
Well, so that's another part of the grant that we're excited about. This is a new part. The American Academy of Colleges of Nursing has put together a program, Holistic Admissions Review Workshop. So this program provides an assessment of our admissions processes and focuses on student recruitment and retention strategies and models building a successful mentoring program. So it will help us focus on students of diverse backgrounds and how we might recruit them and admit them. We might have to use different strategies than we do for the typical student to focus on those students. So it will be a whole education process for us. And 10,000 of this grant will go every year to help us focus on those admission processes.
It seems likely that you will be forging relationships with first-generation students with regards to this particular grant. How are you going to go about doing that?
Absolutely. And once again, it's focusing on those special needs. Those students haven't been exposed, as other students might have been, to college or, you know, like their parents, oh, this is my alma mater, let's go check it out. They haven't had that kind of exposure and rah-rah for a certain university.
And that can be kind of intimidating when they're coming into an academic environment.
Right, because their parents haven't been there. So the parents are intimidated, as are the students. So the ways we focus on how can we reach out to them and get them excited about coming to Mennonite and coming to Illinois State. Those are some of the things we're focusing on. So it's a four-year grant, and we, of course, are a four-year program. We admit as freshmen, which is a little different than most nursing programs. We have direct admit from high school. So students know when they commit to us as a freshman, they will be in our program 4 years and graduate. And one of the things that Mennonite has a great reputation for is keeping our students. There are a lot of colleges and schools of nursing that try to weed students out, and we try to keep students in, and our focus is on success. We have what we call a whole success plan. So you have to almost want to not be successful to leave Mennonite, because we work really hard. It's part of what we're about.
Judy, how competitive are these grants?
The grants, they will be competitive. There'll be about 12 of them, so we have a lot of students. Because we don't have a lot of diversity, I think it won't be such that there'll be lots of students that aren't getting it. I think, you know, we'll be able to give those out and not leave a lot of people behind. The program, not all of the students need the money. A lot of them maybe have other financing, but the programming we offer to everyone. So everyone can get the mentoring. Anyone can join our PROUD program. And even if they don't qualify financially, they can still get the tutoring, the mentoring, all those kind of things. So we try to be as inclusive as possible.
The Advanced Nursing Education Workforce Grant is going to help put nurse practitioners into areas that are underserved.
Correct.
Into rural areas. So on the one hand, you've got the grant to bring in the diverse workforce, and then this other grant will allow you to help place nurses into areas that are underserved, into rural areas. And that's something people have been talking about a lot lately, in that doctors aren't going into rural areas, particularly very recently because of visa issues. And also because doctors who are here are having to pay off big student loans, so they're taking bigger money jobs into the cities and that sort of thing. So how will something like that impact nurses, nurse practitioners who are going into rural areas if they're not getting doctors there as well?
So, Laura, I think one of the things that I'm so proud about nursing and about Mennonite getting these grants is we're about the community, we're about the region, and helping this region receive health care. And nurses are 3 million strong. I don't know if you know that nationally. There are 3 million of us, and I think the future of health care is nursing, because we're going out into those rural areas and we can make a difference in health care. And so having nurse practitioners in rural areas, that's where they live. Many times, as you said, physicians struggle with going into a rural area where they're not going to make as much money. But many times our nurse practitioners are living in those rural areas or have a 10 or 15 minute drive to a primary care clinic. And that's what this grant is about, is educating nurses to function in primary care clinics where we're doing population health. We're managing a population of patients. We need to keep patients out of the hospitals and healthy with their high blood pressure, their diabetes, their congestive heart failure. We can manage them in rural settings without them having to drive long distances to hospitals or being cared for there. So this is a wonderful grant that will educate those nurse practitioners to stay in rural areas.
Are there unique primary care needs in the rural areas?
There is a difference just in accessibility, for one thing. And here in Bloomington Normal, we have Fresh Market. I mean, you can name all the wonderful grocery stores that we have where you have access to all wonderful, healthy foods. So in rural areas, there's a lot less of that. How far do you have to drive? Well, maybe there's the corner market or something. But yeah, there are different constraints on access to healthcare, to pharmaceuticals, to food that maybe a primary care nurse in a rural setting would have to work with that patient on. How do I get access to these things just because of availability? So it is a different culture.
It really feels like the nurse practitioners who go into a rural area are more woven into the fabric of the community. They're like a pillar of the community there rather than in a larger community like Bloomington Normal, where there's lots of nurse practitioners and they're very helpful in that sort of thing. But if there's just one nurse practitioner in an area, that's a very important person.
Absolutely. And there are partners. We're partners in healthcare. And this doesn't preclude the physician. We're all important in the healthcare trajectory. Everybody plays a part. And that's what I love about the nurse practitioner doing his or her role in caring for the patient. If there's something out of our scope of practice as a nurse practitioner, we send them on to the physician to get that extra help. But the nurse practitioner and even the RN can do a lot of the care that we need here in the United States now for good health care and keeping them out of the hospital, healthy in their own community.
We have a lot of students here at Illinois State University who come from the Chicagoland area, who come from the suburbs, and they come here to school. And I hear this a lot from students who, when they're done with school, they want to go back up to the suburbs. Do you hear that? What do you hear from your students in the Mennonite College of Nursing? Are they anxious to go back home, back into the Chicago area, or do they want to fan out into different areas of the community? Do you find students in the Mennonite College of Nursing who are excited about going into rural areas?
We have a nice mix. We have the students that definitely want to go back to Chicago and the excitement of the big hospital, those kind of things. But we also have a nice mix that are interested in across the board, public health, primary care. There's really a change in this generation of realizing we need to care for those who are less fortunate than us and really reaching out. And we tap into that with those students to say, here's where you can help and make a difference with those patients. It's not the glamour. It's not going to be the big paycheck, but you're making the difference, and that's an appeal for sure.
Some community colleges have been adding nursing degrees. How do you think this will be impacting these situations? Will they be a sort of buttress to what you are trying to do here?
I think the good news for the Bloomington Normal area is we have a wonderful partnership with our community colleges, and particularly in Heartland. Not only do we have a pathway program where students can do their 2 years at Heartland and then they're connected with Illinois State and the Mennonite College of Nursing, and they come straight in once they finish their associate degree, they come straight into the Mennonite College. But we also now are just signing an agreement with Heartland to do what we call a dual entry. So they are admitted both to the Mennonite College of Nursing and Heartland at the same time. So they're a dual student. They take classes at both all 4 years, and they graduate both with an associate's degree and then with a bachelor's degree in nursing in approximately 4 years. We've worked it out. So we have a wonderful partnership. So yeah, there's a lot of things going on with some community colleges talking about offering the baccalaureate program. What we find is a baccalaureate at a community college would be different from a baccalaureate at a four-year institution. We have a larger and stronger focus on research and those kind of things that they're not going to get. I don't ever want to say anything bad about a community college because I love them. We need them. But I find in my background that working together, we have a stronger student and a stronger baccalaureate. It's important to me that we as nurses have say in how we're educated. And I really think the four-year institution is the way to go for a baccalaureate-prepared nurse.
So there's a lot of talk today about healthcare reform, and a lot of talk about that right now. How do you see that, Judy, as impacting nursing?
I think it's the perfect entrance for nursing to realize that we can be a leader in healthcare, and we need to continue to have our voice. Because as I said before, I envision the nurse of the future. I envision in the next 20 years that nurses will be on the forefront. We need to be boots on the ground out there keeping patients out of the hospital and caring for them in the community. I think we could bring a healthcare that could kind of flip things upside down. If nurses could be reimbursed, you may or may not know this, but when you go to the hospital and you get your hospital bill, you don't get a bill for nursing. You get a room charge, and nurses are included in that. That feels a little degrading, doesn't it?
It does.
So someday I envision RNs who are caring for patients. They have their own schedule and they see you. They make sure, you know, that you're eating right. You're doing all the things that you do. You're taking your medications. All those things that nurses can, RNs can do, not even a nurse practitioner. And it would cost far less. Healthcare would cost far less. So in about 20 years, I think we need to do a total flip. Everyone, we need to have physicians, but they need to be seeing the sickest of the sick with their level of expertise. Nurse practitioners in the middle caring for all those other things. And then the RN or the LPN caring for the majority of patients out here at a reasonable cost that we as a society can afford. That's my dream. You ask, so I'm telling you. I think nurses could flip and really change healthcare. That's my vision.
With these two grants that total $3.4 million, will this have any sort of impact on the potential new Mennonite College of Nursing building? They've torn down the dorms. There's a big empty space there. And it's hoped that one day that Mennonite College of Nursing will have its own building here on the campus of Illinois State University, there on the southeast side. Do grants like this help get alumni excited and donors excited and other financial institutions who might want to say, you know what, they're getting all these grants, we need to get behind them and push and get them the building that they need to do their work?
That is exactly right. That's what I think it does. It demonstrates that we are a quality program that you could invest in and that you could say for the future, yes, we need to have a building. We're talking with the community about ways, how can we have a building if the state's not going to be able to work with us for several years, which is what we think could possibly be the, you know, the future. But what about our community partners coming together and saying, how can we put together a primary care clinic to start with and then build on that, do a building in phases that benefits not only the College of Nursing, but also we want it to be interprofessional. We want to bring in social work, kinesiology, all the different psychology, everybody that needs to be seen by a patient, communication sciences disorders. We could all work together in a building. We need to care for the patients together, so why not learn together? And then how is it going to benefit the community? What are the needs of the community? We know there we still have a lot of psych, mental health, behavioral health needs in this community. Could we have a building that benefits the community in that way? So we're just exploring. But these kind of grants, not only do they benefit the community in other ways, but they're a leverage to say the College of Nursing is doing great things and we can invest in them for the future. So that's my hope.
That's Judy Neubrander, Dean of the Mennonite College of Nursing at Illinois State University. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The grants awarded to the Mennonite College of Nursing are highly sought after by schools, but not easy to get. Only 50 grants are awarded to qualified applicants in the U.S.
GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the long-delayed and accumulating problem of low-level nuclear waste in Illinois. The state funding crisis is not over with the passage of a state budget. And for school districts, it's arguably worse than it was. Unit 5 in Bloomington Normal will start the school year on the regular schedule and keep the doors open as long as it can. But unless something happens quickly in Springfield on a new school funding formula, now deadlocked between the governor and the legislature, there will be no state money coming. Marty Hickman is the business manager of Unit 5. How long can you keep the doors open?
It's kind of a complicated question, actually, or a complicated answer. If we look at just our fund reserves, it's about 40 days of school.
How does it become complex after that initial assessment?
The complexity is really because we receive a large part of our revenue in the summertime because of the property tax payment. So we can actually go longer than 40 days here at the beginning of the school because we have all that revenue that came in early. If our revenue was split out and paid over, you know, evenly over 12 months, it would be a little bit different. But we have all that revenue up front, along with the fund reserve. So really, it would be something more than 40 days that we could make it.
How much more?
I guess my best estimate would be somewhere around 70 to 75 days.
What does that do to you later on in the year, though?
That's a great question. And from my perspective, it's hard for us to answer because we don't know exactly what the scenario would be. So, you know, our understanding is without further action in Springfield, nothing would be paid out in what used to be the general state aid portion of payments, because it must be paid out under the evidence-based funding formula, which hasn't been signed into law yet. But there are some other pieces, smaller pieces in the education fund that our understanding is they would still be paid. But probably a little bit more importantly is some bigger pieces in the transportation fund could still be paid.
Well, that would keep the buses rolling. But otherwise, isn't this much like you've been operating under for the last 2 years with no state budget?
Yes. It's very much like the last 2 years, if anything, maybe a little bit worse, just because, as you recall, last year, there was a state budget for K-12 education. So the general state aid payments began coming on time. Now, the mandated categorical payments actually did not come on time, and actually they only paid out two of the four last fiscal year. But at least the general state aid came. And that's the largest amount of money that our school district receives was under that general state aid formula. So this year, without the passing of the evidence-based funding formula, that larger portion of payments would not come.
Would the district borrow to stay open beyond the 40 or 70 days?
So those are scenarios that we are looking into. Right now, we're just trying to build those contingency plans, and because of just all the uncertainty, it's even hard to build those plans.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Marty Hickman, the business manager for Unit 5 Schools. What does the current SB1 do for Unit 5 financially?
SB1 would provide about $416,000 more in state funding than we received last year. In general, we are very pleased that the evidence-based funding model seems to be gaining some traction. And in fact, the budget that was passed at the state level, although there's work to be done and it's critical that they finish this step, you know, it contains a piece in there that only allows the funding of schools through the evidence-based model, which is a major improvement from the former general state aid model.
Early in the discussion of the evidence-based model possibilities, it seemed like Unit 5 was not going to fare all that well under it. Then there was this hold harmless provision put in by both sides in order to gain passage. How does Unit 5 fare going forward under the model?
It certainly isn't a windfall for Unit 5, but it does at least provide some stability. Now, there's some increased revenue under that model, but I think more importantly, it really aligns educational spending, educational funding to things that are actually proven to provide results in the classroom and student achievement.
And that's what has caused the education community to sign on to the model. But how do you think it will affect Unit 5 going forward, given the demographic trends that you know? Well, poverty, a general income, age of the community, property tax base of the community, and, of course, the educational outcomes portion that you're already doing with class sizes and with support systems for those in poverty, which gain certain benefits under the formula.
What I believe it does for us longer term, and a key piece of this, is it can be the best model in the world, and it certainly is an improvement over what we had. But if the payments don't actually come to the school district, then we're right back to where we started. So, you know, assuming that the payments are actually made at the levels that they say that they're going to pay them, then at the very least it provides Unit 5 with a little more stability than we've had in the past. And then once we can count on something more solid from the state standpoint, that allows us to then do better future planning to address all the needs that you mentioned, the poverty rate and the different demographics of our community.
What else are you looking at as lawmakers and the governor have their current standoff over how to benefit Chicago or not, and how to pay for what Republicans have asked for in school vouchers? What are you paying attention to politically?
We're always mindful and paying attention to what is being talked about in Springfield. There's been so much, especially over this political season and trying to get this most recent budget passed, that it again comes down to something that's very hard to plan for, because we heard of, there were many different funding models. There was a property tax freeze potential in there that did not come true. So we're always watching all of those developments and planning the best we can. But many times there's not much you can implement or plan for until you know really solidly what's going to happen in Springfield.
One of those unknowns is just yet is how much the pension costs are being shifted. Do you know how soon that's going to take effect, at what level, and how do you assess it based on your average attrition per year?
We don't know the answer to that, the pension cost shift, you know, if it's coming soon or if it is, what exactly that's going to mean. But just as an example, a 1% shift in the pension to the school district would be about $600,000. So, again, something we follow closely, and that alone can have a major impact on the district finances.
Yeah, put that in scale for listeners, would you?
Our education fund alone, which is our biggest fund, is roughly a $98 million fund. So this would be an additional $600,000 in expenses for the district.
Doable, but certainly not pleasant.
Correct, and not doable without other expenses being removed.
Would you eventually have to go for a referendum as older teachers on the existing state-supported pension cycle out of their careers and newer ones that you're paying for cycle in?
I don't know that we really have an answer to that at this point, whether or not we would have to go for a referendum to address just the pension side of things. I don't believe so, because I've also heard there's potential on the pension piece that there's going to be an additional tier potentially installed. It's really going to come down to what exactly is done with the cost shift, and then how they're going to allow us to fund that at a local level if we can.
Why aren't the answers known yet? What remains to be worked out?
Well, that's a great question, and that comes back to an earlier question, is for the last few years, there's so many unknowns all the way through the fiscal year, right? So we're actually almost one full month into our new fiscal year, and we still really have no certainty over state funding.
What is your average attrition per total employment in Unit 5?
The pension amount is just a percentage of a total payroll. So,
yeah, but for instance, District 87 has an employment of about 400, according to Barry Riley, and they cycle about 15 new teachers per year. What's your rate of refreshment?
On average, it's about 35, roughly 900 teachers.
It takes a long time to totally turn over the workforce, but as you pointed out, some of those new people may enter under a different tier.
Correct. There's just so many unknowns on that piece still. I think what's critical to us right now, the most critical question, is how quickly they can pass the evidence-based funding formula. I know that SB1 has already passed the House and the Senate. I know Senator Berrickman has proposed SB 1124. But whichever model, they're both better for Unit 5, and I believe both better for K-12 education in general because they are evidence-based. But regardless, the faster that they can take action on that in Springfield gives us some certainty at the school district on payments and allows us to do our planning.
Marty Hickman is the business manager for Unit 5. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois is home to more nuclear waste than any other state. Plans to get rid of it have never been implemented. Now, President Trump has renewed the idea to move all of the country's waste to a central location in Nevada. For this week's Illinois Issues Report, Daisy Contreras talked with Kevin McDermott, who examined the nuclear waste issue.
Illinois is one of more than 30 states that have nuclear power plants within their borders. And within Illinois, the problem of what to do with the waste from those plants is actually worse than the situation in any other state. Illinois, because it has more nuclear power plants than anyone else, it's actually got 6 active sites right now, plus a 7th site at Zion that's been shuttered. And all of these sites have nuclear waste on them that's been produced from these reactors. So without a federal repository to put this waste, it basically just stays on site. And of the 78,000 tons of nuclear waste that there is sitting around in the United States, about 10,000 tons of that is in Illinois, and that's more than any other state.
And are other states doing anything differently with their nuclear waste?
The other states are doing exactly what Illinois is doing, which is nothing. You know, it's not as if they can set up their own repositories. This is a federal responsibility. I mean, going back to the 80s, the federal government, the Congress passed a law that said the federal government is going to be responsible for collecting and burying and permanently disposing of all nuclear waste in the country. They didn't want it sitting around the whole country at different nuclear power plants. There's environmental hazards, there's health hazards, there's a danger of terrorism. So they wanted this all combined and consolidated in one place. And so the states don't even technically have the authority to set up permanent disposal of their radioactive waste. So it's basically just sitting in there in what they call temporary storage, although in some cases this stuff has been sitting there for decades.
So why hasn't the federal government been able to open up a central repository for all of this nuclear waste if we've seen how it's just being left scattered across the country?
Well, this has been mainly a political problem. The question becomes, if you're going to have a central repository where all the nuclear waste in America goes, who wants that? Well, clearly nobody wants that. Now, what Congress decided was they're going to put this in the Mojave Desert out in the middle of Nevada, under a place called Yucca Mountain. Nevada didn't want it and sued repeatedly over the years to try and stop it. It didn't appear the lawsuits were going to work. The project was moving forward until Barack Obama became president and needed his ally in the Senate, Harry Reid, who happens to be from Nevada and is one of the biggest critics of the plan to put the nuclear waste in Nevada. It was President Obama's administration that said they were going to stop funding the Yucca Mountain project, which had basically just started in terms of actual work, actual digging. and essentially scuttled the program without offering anything in its place. And this was, they had their stated reasons for doing it, and there were some claims that Yucca Mountain was not suitable for this purpose, and some scientists agree, but the politics were pretty clearly there. Obama needed Harry Reid, and Harry Reid didn't want that thing there, and that's essentially why it stopped.
What seems to be the future of the issue? Will there be any changes?
Well, the light at the end of the tunnel, for at least from the point of view of people who were in favor of the Yucca Mountain Project, is that the Trump administration appears to be interested in restarting it. Again, this was a project that was ended under Obama for what a lot of people claim was political reasons, and Trump's administration and its new budget proposal lays out $120 million to restart the project. Now, that's not very much money in the scope of a multi-billion dollar program, but it's an indication that they want to continue what had been started before. And in fact, the administration itself has plainly said that they think that this is something that should be restarted. So again, it's still going to be controversial, but from the point of view of people who think that something needs to be done, that it needs to be put in a central repository, and that that should be Yucca Mountain, that would be progress.
For Illinois Issues, D.Z. Contreras talked with Kevin McDermott about the nuclear waste issue in the U.S. This has been Sound Ideas. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast or individual interviews. Today, with help from Mike McCurdy and Laura Kennedy, that's WGLT.org. Also, where you can find contact information to let us know what you think of this show or share your thoughts at Facebook.com/WGLTFM. Tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We are all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. This is GLT 89.1 FM.